Welcome to the podcast. We're here today with Joaquin Sapien, who spent much of the last year looking into the issue of prosecutorial misconduct. Lately, he's been delving into the case of Eitan Peetz, a six-year-old boy who vanished from the streets of New York more than 30 years ago. Welcome, Joaquin.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Tell us a little bit how you got into this story, which is a story of sort of lore and legend in New York City. You're not a New Yorker, so talk a little bit about how you educated yourself about this and how you got into it.
Well, as you know, we've spent much of the last year looking at the issues of prosecutorial misconduct and how prosecutors sometimes withhold evidence or overlook certain things or don't show their hand at trial and how that can really backfire and cause wrongful convictions. And one of the things that's come up as a major recent phenomenon that's been discovered as to why wrongful convictions occurred are false confessions. And there's been a lot swirling around this case that might indicate that the person who's come forward and confessed to this particular crime may have confessed falsely. So that's part of why we became interested in it. It's also been the obsession of my editor, Joe Sexton, for a couple of years now. Ever since this guy came forward 2 years ago, he just thought that it was a fascinating case to look into for a number of reasons. I mean, the details of the man's confession itself seem somewhat questionable in terms of they don't seem to match the sort of well-known facts around the crime. And yet they've chosen to pursue the prosecution against him anyway. So we thought we might take a look and see what evidence has been gathered since Pedro Hernandez came forward and confessed to this historic murder 2 years ago.
Well, let's back up a little bit for our listeners who may not be sort of daily readers of the New York City tabloids and papers. Tell us a little bit about this case. Why has this so occupied the minds of people in this city for so many years?
It's really become one of the most famous unsolved New York City mysteries. 33 years ago, Eitan Peetz, a six-year-old boy who grew up in the Soho neighborhood of Manhattan, disappeared on the way to his school bus stop and vanished without a trace. They never found a body. No DNA evidence ever turned up. No fingerprints. There was no crime scene. And the boy's father is a photographer and had many, many pictures of this beautiful little boy. And the images that he took of this boy became ubiquitous in the city at that time. I mean, his face was everywhere here. And it garnered international attention. Law enforcement went as far as Israel to track down, you know, alleged sightings of this kid. And they acted on a tip from a psychic to look into the East River trying to find this boy. And people over the years became very likely suspects, but prosecutors declined to go after them. There's just been a number of really interesting turns, and every step of the way, it's garnered huge media attention.
Right. And until 2 years ago, no one had ever been charged in the case.
That's right. And the person that's been charged is an interesting character himself. He is a 52-year-old disabled construction worker by the name of Pedro Hernandez. He's got no known criminal history, led a pretty lackluster life. Has had a couple of marriages, has a couple of kids, but there's nothing really in his record that, you know, he's not a child molester or a sex offender or anything like that, never been involved in any kind of violent crime. So, you know, nothing in his history would suggest that he might be capable of doing something like this. But what happened was the FBI got a tip that the boy's body might be somewhere buried in a basement near where he disappeared. And as they were digging up that basement, there was a lot of attention on that. There was front page news for several days. And a member of Pedro Hernandez's family, or a one-time acquaintance of his, went to the law enforcement and said, you know, Pedro has been rambling about this for years. We think he might be involved. And so they go and they pick him up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and apparently he made some statement that was of interest to them, and they brought him into an interrogation room. But what happens next is very troubling. They have him for 7 hours in an interrogation room that's fully equipped to video record him, and yet they don't turn on the video camera.
Now, are video cameras required in these situations? Because we have heard a lot about this false confession thing, and I know some states do require it. Is it required in the city of New York or in the state of New Jersey?
It is required in New Jersey. It's been the law there since 2005. And so we know that the interrogation room in Camden was equipped to video record his interrogation. That's where he was first taken.
Camden, New Jersey.
Camden, New Jersey, the Camden County Prosecutor's Office. It is not the law in New York, but both Police Commissioner Kelly and Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance sat on a panel convened by the state chief judge that made this recommendation saying the most vital way that you can prevent wrongful convictions stemming from false confessions is to record interrogations. In very strong terms, they recommended that the legislature make this law in New York State. And they do that because people in these situations can falsely confess, particularly when they've got the background of somebody like Pedro Hernandez. And so the police know that this is the kind of person who might say something that's incorrect in the course of a 7-hour interrogation, and yet they disregard that and they don't tape it. So the short answer is it's a law in New Jersey. It's not the law in New York, but there's a lot of reason out there to record people, and there's the bosses of the people that were handling this interrogation have said in no uncertain terms that these things ought to be recorded.
All right. Now, we therefore don't have a tape, but we have the detective's notes on the session. According to the detectives, what does Hernandez say that is incriminating?
So he tells them a story that a lot of people find somewhat hard to believe. He says that he saw Eitan waiting at his bus stop. He lured him into the basement through a hatch on the sidewalk. He strangled
the basement of what?
In the basement of a bodega where Pedro Hernandez was working at the time.
And that's actually true. He was working in
this
place?
He was working there at the time, yes.
So at least he could have physically done it.
That's possible. So he lures him in, you know, strangles him immediately, puts the boy's body while he's still alive into a bag, and puts the bag into a box and takes it a block and a half away in broad daylight. And what's become known over the years, I mean, this was a subject of huge police attention, obviously, when the kid disappeared and they interviewed people that were at that bus stop that morning, and nobody ever saw him there. So that's one thing.
Nobody
that
ever
conflicts.
Saw the young man.
Nobody ever saw Eitan Pates. Nobody ever saw Pedro Hernandez there. Another thing that stands out is Pedro says he got rid of the boy's book bag behind a freezer in the basement. Nobody ever found that book bag. And he says that he takes the boy a block and a half away in broad daylight. And this is a busy Friday morning, right before Memorial Day weekend. There was bloodhounds sent out through the neighborhood. People scoured that neighborhood for days, weeks on end, looking for a body, and it was never found. So it just doesn't quite fit with the known sort of facts around the crime.
Well, you've done some sort of reporting on this false confession phenomenon. Let's assume for a moment this is a false confession. Why in the world would a 52-year-old guy with, you know, no criminal record confess to such a horrible, horrible crime? What would make him do that?
When I first started looking into this, it didn't make any sense to me that anyone could ever confess to something that they didn't do, especially a rape or a murder where they could serve the rest of their lives in prison. But over time, I came to understand that this is actually a growing phenomenon. Of the 300-some-odd DNA-based exonerations, where there's no question that the person who is convicted is innocent, nearly 25% of those people confessed to the crime. And there's some people who are particularly at risk of making false confessions. And Pedro Hernandez meets many of those criteria. So some of those criteria are people who are mentally ill, people who are mentally disabled, have low IQ.
And what's Pedro's IQ?
Pedro's IQ is 67. And if you've got an IQ of 70 or below, you're retarded or borderline retarded. So he's right in there. And they often come as a result of crimes that are well publicized and in the news. So there's a number of facts that are out in the public domain that the confessor can pick up on. And so they can give a relatively detailed confession that sounds believable because there's so much that's known about the crime to the general public. The last factor is they come after long interrogations. This interrogation was 7 hours, which is extraordinarily long. And the reason why people who have those kinds of problems are vulnerable is because police are trained to use psychologically oriented tactics. They can lie to people. They can create scenes. They can put people in those scenes. They can suggest all kinds of different scenarios that this person may have been there. And over time, a mentally ill person might come to believe that they actually did it in the course of the questioning.
Now, do we know anything from the records the detectives did compile from this, their notes or whatever, which, if any, of these techniques were used?
Well, there's something called the Reed technique that's widely used by police, and some of the things that take place there are the tactics that I've just described, where people are, you know, the consequences of giving a confession are minimized, they're placed at the scene, they're lied to, things like that. But since the interrogation wasn't recorded, we have no idea what actually took place in those 7 hours. And that's why it's so critical to videotape these so that a judge and or a jury can look at the actual interrogation and decide for themselves, was this person manipulated or is this an accurate confession? And in states that have the law where it's required that you videotape, law enforcement really likes that it's the law because it makes it very simple for them in court. They can just go to the judge or jury and say, this guy is now claiming that his confession is false, but look at the tape. It looks pretty accurate to us. You know, we weren't doing anything in there that we weren't coercing him in any way. And it makes it very straightforward for people to make a decision as to whether or not they can believe the confession. But that wasn't done in this case.
Now, as you tell the story, it does sound like a pretty shaky case. And yet we have the district attorney in Manhattan, Cyrus Vance, son of the famous Cyrus Vance, Secretary of State, recently elected, taking this case on, a case that is going to unfold in court in the glare of publicity. If they lose this, which sounds like they might, it's going to be a devastating loss for the district attorney. Why would a good prosecutor under these circumstances go forward? And was there any disagreement about that within his office?
We talked to a number of former prosecutors who say that, yes, this was a very divisive issue in the office. There was a number of people there who did not believe that there was enough evidence to convict this person, and it was not responsible to charge him. Obviously, there are others that believe that it was worth pursuing that case. Unfortunately, they didn't comment on the story, so we don't really know what the underlying rationale is, but they've said publicly that they believe this confession. They don't think that his mental illness has any bearing on the legitimacy of it and that it should be left to a jury to decide. And there are competing schools of thought out there among prosecutorial experts as to what should be done in a situation like this. Some people believe that prosecutors are on the front line and juries are fallible, and prosecutors should use their discretion and say, even in the face of great public pressure and pressure from police, that the appropriate thing to do is to decline to pursue charges when there's not enough evidence.
Which, in fact, had happened with a previous suspect in this case.
It's exactly what happened with a previous suspect under a previous administration. And there was a lot of reason to believe that this guy might actually be guilty. He's got a long track record of child molestation. He had a relationship with Eitan Pates' babysitter at the time that he disappeared, and he very nearly confessed to two FBI agents, a federal prosecutor, and two jailhouse informants. And yet, Cyrus Vance's predecessor, Robert Morgenthau, declined to pursue charges against him. And actually, Cy Vance did himself, despite an impassioned plea from Eitan Pates' own father, who really believed that this was the guy who was truly responsible.
This guy's status today is what?
He is currently serving time in state prison in Pennsylvania for separate child molestation charges. And he has been called as a material witness in the case against Hernandez. So he'll have to testify at trial, which could create quite a bit of doubt about the guilt of Pedro Hernandez. And that's really all the defense attorney in this situation has to do, is create enough reasonable doubt, and the jury will have to dismiss it.
So looking forward, we're now in 2014, and the case, I think, is on the docket. When might we expect a trial?
Well, the next major step is going to take place in March, and there's going to be a hearing where the judge will be asked to evaluate the legitimacy of Pedro's confession. So psychiatric experts may be brought in to explain why someone in his condition may have falsely confessed, and certainly the fact that the confession wasn't taped will be a big issue. And it's possible that the case could get tossed right then and there. But if it moves to trial, it's scheduled to begin later in the spring. April 23rd was the anticipated start of the trial date. But there's been a lot of delays in discovery, and the whole case has been drawn out now for more than 2 years. So we'll have to wait and see whether or not they're going to be able to meet that date to actually begin the trial.
Now, one part of that discovery has been the disclosure of fairly detailed mental health records on Hernandez, you know, and some fairly unsavory things about him. Can you tell us what they are and what do they mean?
Sure. So he's been evaluated by his attorney's own psychiatric experts, who are highly regarded as some of the best in the country, maybe even the world, as far as people's mental health and whether they're at risk to make a false confession. And he's been diagnosed as having schizotypal disorder by the mental health people at Bellevue, by the state.
And what's that mean?
It means you could be prone to delusions, hallucinations, auditory and visual. And it's sort of close to a schizophrenic person who hears voices and things like that. And those are the kinds of people who are particularly at risk of making a false confession. So that's part of his history that's been disclosed. And in the course of those evaluations, the experts also spoke to his current wife, who told them about a really dark period of Pedro's history where he was abusing cocaine, and that led to a number of domestic problems. He got violent with her at one point. And so that came out a couple of weeks ago. And so that could also weigh on the jury's opinion as to whether or not he's capable of doing something like this.
Joaquin Sapien, we'll be looking forward to hearing more about this case as it unfolds this year. Thank you very much.
We'll be covering it closely. Thanks for having me.